This is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome all of you to our webinar, Preparing for the CDE Exam. I'm really excited to be presenting this webinar because there's a lot of new and exciting changes in the eligibility requirements to become a certified diabetes educator. And certainly with the epidemic of diabetes and prediabetes, we really need a team of professionals out there reaching out to people at risk for diabetes or living with diabetes to help them improve their health and maybe turn that diabetes around the other direction if they just have the prediabetes. So we'll be talking about the new eligibility requirements. We'll be looking at some updates to the exam. And the last half we'll be spending talking about how do you succeed at this exam. And we'll be doing some sample test questions and giving you some hints on how to use your study time wisely. I know we're all really busy. We have jobs, we have families, we have obligations. So I think the key here is how do we balance our life, get ready for this exam, and succeed. And we're going to be focusing on what are some of the key issues to be ready, most ready as possible for this exam. As I've mentioned, I'm Beverly Tomasian, and you can see that I'm a certified diabetes educator, and I've been a certified diabetes educator for over 20 years, for about 23 years now. I've taken the exam 5 times, and you'll be relieved to know that I've passed it every time I've taken it. But I take it every 5 years because I want to know what's on the exam, and that's how I renew my CDE. Most of you will probably renew it by taking CE credits, but I renew it by retaking the exam because I want to be as familiar as possible with the content on the exam, but more importantly, with the philosophy of the exam, so I can share that with you. As far as questions, I'll be taking questions as there's an opportunity, but if I don't get to them during this program, I will stay after the webinar and answer any questions. So to hear this presentation, you can listen via your computer speaker or your phone. If you have questions, like I said, you can stay afterward or you can email me, bev@diabetesed.net. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us. If you haven't had a chance to download the handouts yet, you can go to our website, diabetesed.net, and under the Resources tab, Free Webinars, you'll see Preparing for a CDE Exam, and there's lots of resources there and also the handouts you can download and print. So what we're going to cover today is, I've mentioned, eligibility requirements, and we're going to spend some time talking about the definition of a diabetes educator. That definition has been updated recently in the NCBDE guidebook, and I think it's really helpful to know as you're getting ready for the exam because they're going to be asking questions on the exam about what is a diabetes educator and what does our role entail. We'll look at the content of the exam, study strategies, and lots of resources. The other thing I have on this slide is a flower. Now, what does a flower have to do with the exam? As it turns out, when I look at flowers, it's very calming for me, and it helps get me refocused. And I think for a lot of us as adults, we haven't taken an exam for a while. We haven't been tested in this type of situation, and it can cause a lot of anxiety. So as we go through this program, these flowers remind us, you know, enjoy the process. It's really, why do we become diabetes educators? Well, we want to be the best at what we do, and also to take a deep breath, relax, and be present. That will help you so much during the exam and as you're studying. So just these flowers remind us that this is a journey that we're undertaking that's going to help us blossom in some way in the future. Some notes of clarification that are really important to me. I want you to know that I have no relationship with the National Credentialing Board of Diabetes Educators. The NCBDE is the official organization that puts together the exam. They figure out what's going to be on the exam, and they help implement the exam. And so I have no insider information from them. I don't have any connection or relationship with them. The way I get my information is just like you. I look at their website, I go to the guidebook, and I take the exam. So this is how I gather the information that I'm sharing with you during this course. And I would always, if you have any questions, go directly to them. They've really revamped their website and their personnel recently, and they're very accessible. And I think what I've noticed from them is they're really interested in increasing the breadth of diabetes educators, which is really exciting. What I'd like to do right now is to launch a poll to find out a little bit about all of you. And I know you answered some questions when you signed up for this web clinic, and I appreciate that, and I've looked at all your answers, but I just want to ask you some questions on the fly right now. When are you planning to take the CDE exam? And you can just click on what's true for you. All right. Most of you have voted, so just take a second more. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to close this and share with you. So about half of you attending today are taking the exam spring 2014. Wow, that's really exciting, and that's coming up pretty soon. 30% of you are taking it in the fall, and the rest of you are taking it a little bit later or not quite sure. Okay, thank you so much. I want to ask you another question, and what content area or areas would you like me to focus on today? And you can choose more than one answer. All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for voting. That really helps me. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share with you. So 45% of you said, let's cover all of it. But you can see that about 50% of you really want to know what's on the exam. So we'll spend time on that. We'll spend a lot of time on that so you feel very comfortable and knowledgeable about what's on the exam. But I do want to spend some time talking about the eligibility requirements just because they've changed, and I think it's good for us to know as diabetes educators. We want to share and let others know how these eligibility requirements have changed, because I think it's going to open up the doors for a lot of people that previously wouldn't have the opportunity to become diabetes educators. So the question we want to ask ourselves is, why take the CDE exam? You know, why? It's a lot of money, it's time, it's a lot of work, it's a lot of study, it's, you know, there's a lot involved in taking the exam. So why should we do it? And I think it really is a professional and a personal decision that we take seriously. And I love being a CDE. I mean, it just was one of the best career choices I ever made, because I love working with people living with diabetes, and I love working with my colleagues who are working to serve people with diabetes. And the CDE really shows people that you have a specialized knowledge in diabetes, and you're going to promote the best care of patients with diabetes. So as diabetes educators, as CDEs, we possess a specialized knowledge in this chronic condition called diabetes. And the CDE is a recognized standard for competence in diabetes self-management education. So as employers are looking to hire diabetes educators, the CDE is well recognized as a specialty certificate. And given the epidemic of diabetes, and even with the Affordable Care Act, they're really looking to figure out different ways in rural areas to provide diabetes education. So I think CDEs are well positioned not only to teach people with diabetes, but to help the community in developing programs to prevent diabetes. So what is a CDE? And it's a healthcare professional with comprehensive knowledge and experience in diabetes management, but not just diabetes. Look what else they include it now, pre-diabetes and prevention. So we're not only doing a care of those living with it, we're trying to be activists in our community to help prevent diabetes. We educate and support people with diabetes to understand and manage the condition, and we promote self-management. This is really important. As diabetes educators, we don't tell people what to do. And as you know, it's really hard to change behavior. We're going to help people find their own motivation to change behavior, and we're going to individualize the care. So let me get my little pointer here. I think some of the key things that you will notice on the exam is individualize and behavior change. So we're really trying to move people toward changing their behavior to optimize their health outcomes. Really important. Let me get my marker back to this. So what are some, let me get rid of this yellow mark here. Hang on, erase all drawings. There we go. What are some of the professional qualifications to take the CDE? And you probably are familiar with these. You know, RN, RD, PA, OT, healthcare professionals with a master's degree in social work from a U.S. college. So many of these require that you get these degrees from a United States college or from its territories. In addition to having this professional licensure, you also must have professional practice experience. And this has been changed a little bit in 2014, so I'd like to go over that with all of you. And that is, you need a minimum of 2 years of professional practice experience under your degree. So whatever your degree is, you have to be doing that for 2 years, your professional licensure. Plus, you have to have a minimum of 1,000 hours of professional practice experience within the past 4 years. And 40% of it needs to be in the most recent year. So the year that you apply, you have to have accumulated 400 hours, which equals about 8 hours a week. Plus, you need 15 clock hours of continuing diabetes education within 2 years before applying for certification. So you need to have all of these things before you even think about application. But there's a new eligibility that I'm so excited about. It's for health educators. So these now health educators who hold the Master Certified Health Education Specialist credential, plus meet if they meet all of the other requirements, can start applying to take the exam in 2014. So this is terrific. This means that you don't have to have your RN or your RD or your, you know, other licensure. You can take the CDE with a master's degree and the certification in health education. In addition, there's another pathway to become eligible for the CDE exam. It's called the Unique Qualifications Pathway. And this is designed for health professionals holding an advanced degree in health-related area or concentration. So I just want to say to you, that's pretty vague. You know, that right there, it seems like there's a lot of opportunities for possibilities for different professions. And so if you think you might be qualified or you know someone who might be qualified, I would definitely have you call the NCVDE because there is required a pre-application. That is, you have to call them, contact them, email them, and say, hey, this is my master's degree. Can I pursue my CDE? And if they say yes, and there's a pre-application that costs about $150, then you can go ahead and work toward gathering not 1,000 hours, but 2,000 hours of diabetes self-management experience. So they're asking for double the amount of time for people in this situation. But still, it's a door that's open that was not open before. Talking a little bit more about professional practice hours, what is included? Well, only hours after your degree can be utilized as your practice hours. You need 1,000 hours if you have those different licensures, but if you're on the unique qualifications pathway, 2,000 hours are required of practice experience. This is new, and this is so exciting. It's an additional opening of the door, and that is before you could only have 400 hours count toward you could only have 400 volunteer hours count towards your professional practice experience. But now in 2014, all 1,000 hours required can be volunteer hours. And it doesn't have to be under an NCVDE approved provider or mentor. It can be at a clinic, it can be at the diabetes camps, as long as you have a supervisor who can attest that you are providing diabetes self-management education. So you have to meet the criteria and be providing DSME, which I'll define in a minute, but if your supervisor says yes, those hours count. So wow, that's exciting. And for those of us working as CDEs, it's exciting for us because then we can have our colleagues come join us and work with us who want to accumulate those hours. But on the other hand, there are some activities that don't count toward practice hours, and I just want to show you these very briefly. So this first one's pretty obvious, demonstration of a skill that does not include one or all of the components of DSME. Supervising other professionals, providing medical assessment. So I want to say if you're a provider, when you provide medical assessment, diagnosis, or treatment, that's not counted as education. Really what they're trying to say is only the time where you're providing diabetes education and helping people change behavior is counted toward those required hours. And here's some more activities that don't count. But this list, I want to be honest with you, has shortened a lot. So they really are trying to say, we want to include people who are ready and have the experience and are, you know, passionate about becoming a diabetes educator, we want to make sure they have that opportunity. Now, here's a checklist. I just took it right from the NCBDE handbook of if you say yes to all of these, you're ready to take the exam. And the number 7 is continuing education activities. You need 15 hours within the past 2 years. And I'd like to invite you to come to our conferences. I have to say our team of instructors have been providing diabetes education classes for over 15 years, and we love teaching classes. We provide this level 1 class, and it's at UCSF, and that's for people just entering the field of diabetes. It's coming up very shortly, but we still have room. We'd love for you to attend. And it's 2 weekends of great information. And the level 2 course is for those of you who are getting ready to take the exam in the next year, and it's happening April 9th through 11th, and that's happening in Modesto, California. We also have it in the fall in beautiful San Diego. And all of our courses, whether you come join us online or live, qualify towards your CDE. And if you received our email, we did offer a special discount on our Prep for CDE bundle. Now, this is from our online courses. We have over 20 online courses that are approved for CE credit for your CDE. And this particular bundle is our hottest seller because it has courses geared toward people getting ready to take the exam. So if you can't join us live, which is always best to come to our live courses, this is definitely an option to join us on our online program. And you get a great discount, $30 off, if you just submit the word almond in the checkout when you purchase this bundle. Okay, so this is a really important slide. What is the definition of diabetes self-management education? And again, this is important as you gather your practice hours, but also as you're getting ready for the exam. You want to know how they define diabetes self-management education, because they're going to ask questions on the exam about this. And sometimes they're going to kind of trick you, and they want you to choose a medical model, but we're not doing medical model. We're doing education, and we're helping change behavior. Diabetes self-management education is provided by health professionals who have appropriate credentials and experience, and look who it involves, a person with prediabetes, diabetes, caregivers, support people, and the educator. Really important here. Diabetes education is defined as an ongoing process. So it's not just we sit with the patient once and we give them all the information, they leave, we never see them again. No, we need to connect with that patient over time. Diabetes is a lifelong chronic condition, so we want to make sure that our patients have us as a resource or our classes or support group, or we reach out to them on an ongoing basis to help facilitate knowledge, skills, and the ability necessary for self-care. You all know that diabetes is mostly a self-managed condition, so we want to give our patients all the tools possible so that they can succeed and live as best they can with their diabetes every day. Here's some more definition to be familiar with. It's a component of a comprehensive plan of care, and it incorporates the needs, goals, and life experiences of the person. So again, as we're doing our assessment, we're going to find out, we're going to ask the patient, tell me how your diabetes management's going. You know, what are you struggling with? What are you succeeding with? And we want to gather their experience with diabetes and incorporate it into our teaching plan, which we'll go over in a minute. And it's guided by evidence-based standards. So on my resource page, I have a link to the ADA Standards of Care, the Clinical Practice Guidelines. I would click on those and read through those. If you're going to take the exam, you know, in the spring, in the fall, or you're just thinking about the exam, it's a great document, and a lot of the exam questions do come from the ADA Standards of Care. They're updated every year, and we have the most recent version on our website, and I would just be familiar with that because our diabetes education is based on evidence. We don't want to share information with patients that it's not accurate. So as diabetes educators, we have to be, you know, tenacious at getting to the truth and really sharing with our patients what the science says. Because, you know, patients always tell us there's a lot of wacky stuff out there. So we're trying to help guide them toward the truth and the science. Our goal is to support informed decision-making, self-care behaviors, problem-solving, and active collaboration. You're going to see this a lot on the exam where they talk about, you know, the patient's coming in, they're very depressed. What resources should you, you know, make available to this patient? So we know we're not an island. We're just a part of a team, and we're trying to help the patient get the resources that they need. For the purpose of the certification exam and eligibility, here are activities that are counted towards your professional practice hours in accumulating your DSME hours. So, and this is important for the exam also, what do we do as diabetes educators when we provide diabetes self-management education? We do the assessment. So the assessment is that one-on-one time when we're sitting with the patient, gathering the data, and then based on that assessment, we provide or we develop an education plan. And it's not developed by us. It's developed by the individual and the educator in collaboration. Very important point to keep in mind as you go through, you know, thinking about the exam. This is a perspective they want us to be thinking about. We're going to really focus on self-management support. How do we help that patient succeed when we're not around, which is 99.9% of the time? And then we're going to develop educational interventions to help that individual achieve their goals. We're going to reevaluate, so it's an ongoing evaluation, and we're going to develop a personalized follow-up plan. So all of these are elements of DSME. We've got to document what we do, and we just don't document it and put it in a drawer. We have to share it with the team so the team knows what the plan is and what we're doing and what we're working toward. And the other thing that's new on this latest application is that you can count hours doing program development and administration to support patient education. So if you're helping set up a diabetes education program, those hours count towards your 1,000 hours that are required. Okay, so that's kind of a summary of the, I would call it the philosophy of what's on the exam, kind of the underpinnings of what diabetes educators do and what counts and what's defined as practice hours. Now, once you're ready to apply for the exam, you've done your checklist and you're ready to go, you go online, and at that moment, you'll be notified whether yes, you're ready or you know, no, you don't qualify at this point, or they might actually ask you to submit audit items. Now, if you're requested to send in audit items, here what they might ask of you: a copy of licensure, professional practice experience, and employment verification signed by your supervisor. So a lot of people ask me, well, how do I document my practice hours? Well, once a week I would just keep a log and document how many hours you've accumulated and let your manager know that, you know what, I'm gathering these practice hours and these are the things that I'm doing. This is how DSME is defined. I'm doing these things, so these hours should count. So get your supervisor in on this right away so they know that you're gathering those hours, and if you're requested in the audit to submit it, they can sign it off and you can send it in. The test is computerized, which is terrific. When I first took the exam, it was old Scantron and number two pencils, but now they're totally computerized. So what you do after you sign up is they'll assign you a test. You choose a testing site, and if you want to take the spring test, you have to apply by March 15th to take the test in June, and if you want to do the test in the fall, you have to apply by September 15th. Once you receive your confirmation of eligibility, you want to call, let me just go back one slide, CASEL. CASEL is the group that helps provide the exam. And so you want to get onto their scheduling system. And I would do it early on because you want to get a really good time for yourself to take the exam. And the other thing is you don't have to take the exam where you live. You could actually plan a vacation around the exam. Like when I took the exam 7 years ago, I took it in Hawaii, and I took my whole family to Hawaii. I finished the exam, I turned it in, and then I headed right for the beach and got one of those adult beverages with an umbrella in it, and that was terrific. So I don't know, it's just a thought, because you're working so hard for this exam, you might as well, you know, make it a little bit fun if you can. Sometimes you can't do that, but if you can, it's worth the effort. Now, when will you get your results? This is really important for you spring test takers. In the spring of 2014, it's going to take at least 8 weeks, 8 weeks to get your results. Why? The reason is they just redid the exam. They redo it every 5 years based on an analysis of the job functions diabetes educators perform. And so they just did that analysis in 2013, and based on those results, they've updated the exam for spring. So once you take the exam, they're going to take it back and they're going to analyze it and do statistical analysis to see what's the passing point or do we do these exams correctly. And that's why it's going to take time to get your results. You can see here it's not cheap, $350 to take the exam the first time. To renew, it's $250. And when you get your exam results, I'll just want to let you know you get two result numbers. You get a raw score and a scaled score. The scaled score is what you really want to look at because in order to pass, you have to get 70 scaled score units. And I'll just tell you what a scaled score means. It just says that some questions are harder than others. So harder questions get more weight value. Easier questions get less weight. So they kind of average out the difficulty of your exam to give you your scaled score units. So that's what you're going to be looking for. Okay, this slide is kind of interesting, and I just went to the NCBDE website, and I'm always tracking what's the pass rate, how well are people doing on this exam. And for many years, the pass rate was about 80%, and around 2009, it really did drop to 69%. Why did it drop? I couldn't really find out, but the one thing they did note on the site is that that was the year the test was changed to computerized, and they had just done a work analysis study. And you can see the following years, the test scores even dropped further. And so my hope is with their new job analysis and the new exam that we're going to see the test scores improving. And so I think there's kind of some new things happening at the NCBDE, and hopefully we'll see this number improving. But I still want to tell you something. At 63% or 65% pass rate, that means most people pass. Almost, two-thirds of people pass this exam. So you want to keep that in mind when you're sitting down to take the exam. Most people taking it for the first time pass, and I'm going to be one of those people. And I actually know you have a higher chance of success because you're joining this webinar. So anyone who's participating in webinars, learning as much as they can about it, taking sample or, practice exams, tends to do better on this because you have more information. And the more information you have, the more your anxiety decreases. As we gain knowledge, our anxiety goes down. So that's what you're doing right now. Now, on the exam, there's 200 multiple choice questions. You have 4 hours. So you need to move. You're not going to, dilly-dally around. You're going to just have to keep pushing forward on these test questions. So there's some that are easier, and you're like, oh, that was a no-brainer. You're going to move through those quickly. And there's some that are more difficult, so take your time on those and really think through them because there's degrees of difficulty, so you want to assign more time to the more difficult questions. The important thing to keep in mind about this exam is that the questions are linked directly to a task or tasks. So it's not just they want you to know the diagnostic criteria for diabetes. They want you to know how to apply it in a given situation. So what they're trying to say is when the rubber hits the road, when we're talking to the patient, do you know how to take that scientific information and translate it over to the person to help them change behavior and improve their quality of life? So they want to know, do you have the necessary knowledge to perform a task and the ability to apply it to a job situation? So when I say applying it, what they're saying is they're going to give you case scenarios, case studies. Given, John is 64 years old and he has diabetes type 2, what would you do in this situation regarding medication or regarding, promoting lifestyle behavior change? So they're going to give you scenarios where you have to apply your knowledge. And we're going to be doing some sample test questions at the end of this program so you can kind of practice and get a feel for your test-taking style. The other thing I want to point out is that 25 of the 200 questions are new, but they're not counted. So there's 25 questions in there that might be kind of weird, and those are the ones that don't count towards your test score. You're just trying them out. Okay, so a lot of you wanted to know what is on the exam. So what we're going to do right now is spend a few minutes talking about the exam content. And again, look what I have here, a flower. We're going to take a deep breath and just really be present and relaxed and focused. We like adrenaline. Adrenaline is great for the exam, but we don't want so much adrenaline that it causes anxiety. So we're going to keep our adrenaline in check. Now, the assessment part of the exam is a big part. 45 questions are dedicated to assessment. And then we've talked about that already. It's a very important part of DSME. It's when we're sitting across from that patient trying to gather information to help us and them formulate an education plan. So we're going to be asking them about what they know about diabetes, what self-care behaviors are they engaged in, what is their social and economic milieu, what's their health status, You know, are they able to get up and exercise, or do they have waiting for a hip replacement, so they're kind of in their chair a lot of the time? And then we're going to evaluate their current knowledge and practices related to diabetes care. So the assessment is a springboard. It helps us get the information we need to move on to the next component, which is very, very important, and it's called intervention. And I would say, as I talk to people who are struggling with this exam, intervention is the part that they tend to have the most difficult time with. What does intervention mean? Well, it's after you gather that data from the assessment, you have to develop the educational plan and, you know, help guide the patient toward the best self-care possible. So you can see collaboration is important, where we reach out to the patient, caregivers, support people, healthcare team. But most of the weight comes from teaching and counseling regarding principles of diabetes self-care. So we need to be familiar with medical nutrition therapy, carb counting, medications, insulin. We need to be familiar with gestational diabetes, diabetes in children, diabetes in older patients. We need to be familiar with the wide breadth of diabetes information. And you might say, well, how do I get all that information? And there's different ways. You can purchase a book called the Diabetes Deaths Reference, published by the AADE. It's a very comprehensive review of all aspects of diabetes. You can attend seminars or go to online courses. But hopefully you're gathering this information as you're working and gathering your practice hours, because that's what this exam really tries to get at. It's important to have the knowledge from the textbooks and lectures, but what are you doing every day, and do you really understand and have a good grasp of helping people make changes in their self-care? All right. Review, evaluation, revision, and documentation. So this is just our ongoing documentation of their progress and adjusting goals as needed if patients are struggling with that, and then follow-up and referral. Very important. Okay, the third part of the exam is program development and administration. So this says, what is involved in a diabetes education program? How do we evaluate outcomes? How do we know what we're doing is working? And this is a new one, promoting diabetes advocacy. As diabetes educators, we need to get out there and talk about prevention, and we need to talk to our communities about this public health issue that's really bearing down on us. But as far as this program development, what if you're not involved in setting up a diabetes program and you aren't really familiar with that? Well, we do have an online course called Setting Up a Successful Diabetes Program that's geared just toward this particular aspect: how to set up a program, how to measure outcomes, what's included in the program. And so you can certainly join us online, or in that book we mentioned, the desk reference, it's also available in that. All right. Okay, I have this really good link. For detailed outline, go to ncbde.org exam outline. So on the website of NCBDE, they have a very comprehensive list of all the objectives of what's included in the exam. I would go through that, and as a self-quiz, ask yourself, am I comfortable with all these different areas? And if you're not, that's your area to study more. All right. Now, when you think about taking the test, as I've mentioned before, many of us as adults haven't taken a test for a while, so I like to go over some test-taking strategies, and I think these are really helpful, so we'll just spend a few minutes on these, because as I've talked to people who have taken the exam, these are some of the issues they've come up against, so I do want to point them out for you. So you want to make sure that you don't read the questions so fast that you don't get the main idea, or you don't understand or grasp the key intent of the question. So you want to make sure that you know what they're trying to ask you. Be very clear about that and read the question carefully, looking at all the words. So you want to figure out what is the key intent of the question and get to the stem of it. And we'll talk about this more in a minute. And you always want to look for these words in the question and in the answer. These words our eyes skip over very easily. So take a moment to take a look at these. The words are always, never, most, probably, usually. So these qualifying words are going to give us a lot of information about what is the right answer and what is the wrong answer. And sometimes you may be tempted to choose an answer you did not understand because the other one seemed too easy. So sometimes they're going to give you these juicy answers. They're really complicated and convoluted, but they're not the right one. So you always want to go back and ask yourself, what is the key intent of this question? What are they really asking me? And what question best answers that? Now, I said best answers that because sometimes, and this is happened to me in the exam, you may see two answers that seem like they could be right, but there's always one better answer. So if you're not sure, just say, it's okay, these two seem right, but I'm going to choose the best answer. And that will help guide you to choosing the right answer. Another issue that comes up a lot is empowerment errors. And sometimes we might focus on the medical need rather than the psychosocial need. So this is not an exam, for a provider. You know, it's not based on a medical management of diabetes. This exam is looking at education, self-care behaviors, empowering the patient. So keep that in mind. It's so important because they're going to offer you juicy questions that are more medically focused. But no, we're diabetes educators. The other thing is you want to keep in mind the patient's characteristics. That is, they're going to give you information about how old they are, what their demographics are, socioeconomic status, how many kids they have, you know, different issues that are going to be very important in choosing the right answer. So read those demographics really carefully. Now, as we're working in the field, sometimes we get a question and we're like, oh yeah, I've had that kind of patient. And sometimes we overthink that question. We put in our own life experience into the question. Don't put your own life experience in. Just read the question for what it is and don't add in anything because you only can choose the right answer based on the information in the question. That's really, really important. Okay, so try not to overthink. Just use what you have. And the other thing I would really encourage you to do is take a practice test. Learn how to work test questions. This is especially true if you haven't taken a test for a while. So when you work a test question, what am I talking about? Well, number one, make sure you really understand the question. You want to get to the key intent. Find the stem. What are they really trying to get at? Next thing you're going to do is read all the options or answers. And then quickly you're probably going to say, oh, that's wrong, that's wrong. And then you'll get to those two. And then you got to get rid of one more. So eliminate wrong answers first. And then, this is so important, put a big star by this, select the best option. Don't get thrown if two seem about right. There's always one that's more right. Yes, there is. Okay. The other thing I want to just focus on for a minute, answers with the following words are usually incorrect. So if you see answers with the word always, never, all, none, only, must, completely, they're usually not the right answer. Because in diabetes education, we're dealing with humans. And humans rarely fall into any of these categories. Humans, you know, we're always trying to readjust and make changes and succeed the best we can. But when it comes to behavior change, these words are, you know, really not applicable. So keep an eye out for those. Answers with the following words are usually correct. Seldom, most, generally, tend to, probably, usually. Those words allow for the human condition. And so getting to the right answers. Don't leave any answers blank, and you can mark on your test that you want to go back to a particular question. Look for clues. Don't get lured in by juicy answers. Oh, that's such an important point. There's going to be juicy answers in there that you want to pick, but they don't match the key intent of the question. So really be aware of that. Avoid imposing your life experiences into the question or the answer, and keep breathing. That's really, really important, especially if you just got one of those really hard questions that kind of threw you off. That's a really important time to take a breath and just get refocused. And you know what? I would really encourage you to stand up, stretch. You can move around in the exam. It's totally acceptable. And then if there is any math problems, make sure to work it out on scratch paper. So there's three different types of test questions. There's just like the basic recall. What's a diagnostic criteria for diabetes? What are the side effects of metformin? Things like that. So just basic recall. Then there's application. So you're going to have to look at the patient characteristics and then apply your knowledge. And then the most complicated type of question are analysis. And we'll do all three of these in the upcoming test sample questions. So the analysis, we have to integrate and synthesize and use a lot of different skills and knowledge and information. And so when I've taken the test in the past, the most amount of questions are recall and application. The least amount are analysis. So those are less common in the exam, but when you do get them, they require some thought. Okay, let's do a sample question together, all of us, and then we'll go and I'll launch some questions that you can choose the right answer. So the first question is, which of the following would suggest a diagnosis of new onset type 1 versus type 2 diabetes? So this is pretty easy to find the key intent. What's the key intent? Really, it's symptoms of type 1 versus type 2. It's really what they're trying to find out. So let's take a look at the first possible answer, hyperglycemia. So we're going to think about this. Do people with type 1 diabetes get hyperglycemia? Yeah. And do type 2s? Yep. They both can. So that's not the right answer because it doesn't a unique quality of either of these. It happens in both. So that's wrong. Let me get my marker here. Wrong. Okay. What about polyuria? So we need to know what polyuria is, and you can think poly a lot, urea, urine. So they're going to the bathroom a lot. Does that happen with our type 1s? Yep. Does it happen with type 2s? And you might say to yourself, well, not all type 2s get polyuria, but they could. So since they could, it counts. So it doesn't differentiate between type 1 or type 2, so that's wrong. Okay, ketosis. Now I have to think about, what is ketosis? Well, it's burning a fat for fuel when you don't make enough insulin. So this is looking promising because type 1s do get ketosis, type 2s don't because they make endogenous insulin. So this is looking good, but let's keep going. Polydipsia, what's that? Well, lots of thirst. Do type 1s get that? Yep. Do type 2s? Yep. So that's not a unique quality. So ketosis is our best answer. So I'm sure you all got that one. That's a pretty straightforward one. And if you didn't, you know what? That's okay. It just tells us that, you know, that's an area you want to study, and that is, you know, the pathophysiology and the symptoms of diabetes. Let's go on to sample question 2. MJ has type 1 diabetes and wants to know the possible complications that can result from hyperglycemia during the first trimester of pregnancy. Which of the following complications can result from first trimester hyperglycemia? So again, we want to think about what's the key intent. So if you have type 1 diabetes, what complications can result from hyperglycemia during the first trimester? I'm going to go ahead and launch this question, and you could choose the right answer. Is it macrosomia, vascular defects, shoulder dystocia, or spina bifida? So just take a few minutes to think about what would be the right answer. Somebody was asking me how to get a copy of the slide. So if you go to our website, diabetesed.net, under resources, free webinars, preparing for CDE exam, you can download them right there. And then somebody else asked me while we're doing this test, do you still need the 400 hours within the most recent year? Yes. So those practice hours, you still need 400 of the 1,000 within the most recent year before taking the exam. Okay, so 70% of you have voted. If you wanted to take one more second to make a vote, that would take your best guess. So what if you don't work in gestational diabetes or diabetes in pregnancy? You know, you may not be that familiar with the potential complications during the first trimester of pregnancy for women that have pre-existing type 1 diabetes. So if this is not a familiar area for you, you want to make sure you study about diabetes in pregnancy and gestational diabetes, especially if you only work with non-pregnant adults, because there's going to be questions on the exam about special populations, and gestational diabetes is one of them. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this, and let me just share the results. So macrosomia, many of you chose that, and that means a big baby. So let's think about this for a second. We're talking about potential complications from hyperglycemia and the first trimester of pregnancy. So this is a woman who has pre-existing diabetes, gets pregnant, her baby's being exposed to a lot of glucose in utero, and that little baby's pancreas is really kicking in and making some insulin. But we're looking at the complications from the first trimester. And macrosomia, although it is a complication of gestational diabetes, it's not usually due to the first trimester. Usually we'll see that complication as a result of later in pregnancy. So that is not the right answer. Let me hide the results here so I can mark on this. Yeah, so macrosomia is not the right answer. What about vascular defects? Some of you chose that, and that is not the right answer either. It's very vague, and it really is not a complication that's associated with hyperglycemia in the first trimester of pregnancy. Shoulder dystocia, nobody chose that. Great job. So the shoulder dystocia means when I'm delivering a baby, I have a big baby from exposure to excess glucose in utero, that baby is so large the shoulder dislocates. So nobody chose an answer. Great, great job, everybody. Now, what about D? So all we have left is D, and D is spina bifida. It's a neurological disorder or neurological complication. And that is the right answer because, you know, the first trimester of pregnancy is when organogenesis takes place, when the organs, the nerves are being formed. And if the baby is exposed to a hyperglycemic, the fetus is exposed to a hyperglycemic environment in the first trimester, they do have as one of the complications or neurological problems, in particular, spina bifida. So 25% of you got that right. Great job, team. And as I said earlier, you know, the reason I'm putting these questions out is so that you have opportunity to see what areas are you more comfortable with and what areas require more study. Okay, let's go on to the next slide. Now, this is a vignette-style question, and this happens a lot in the exam where they're going to give you a situation and you have to choose the best answer. Read the following vignette to answer the next three questions. We have a 47-year-old man with newly diagnosed type 2. Here's some additional information we know about him. He's married with two teenagers. He's a professor. He's obese. He started on metformin 500 milligrams twice a day, and his father actually died of kidney failure secondary to diabetes. So keep all those elements in mind as we go on to the question. So based on that information about that patient, so we're going to, you know, do that individualized assessment, and we're going to take that information and apply it to these case studies. Given what you know about this patient, what emotions would you expect him to express, given what you know? Let me pop this up here. All right. Thank you for voting, everybody. It really helps me to get a feel for where you're at and what to focus on, so I really appreciate it. I'm just going to look at some of the questions people are asking me. If you decide to change your answer, can you go back and correct it, even if you've moved on during the exam? Yes, you can. So you can choose an answer and then come back later and change it, no problem. Oh, and then somebody was asking, is there a specific recommended way that you track your hours? No, not really. when you track your hours to gather your practice hours, you just keep a log, and then your supervisor must attest to it. That's the most important point. Would teaching about healthy eating count as hours toward diabetes prevention? Oh, yes, it definitely would. So if you're, you know, out there talking about healthy eating and making good, you know, food choices, absolutely. That is a component of diabetes self-management education. Okay, so let's get back to our question here. 85% of you have voted. And let me go ahead and close the poll. And I just want to say you all really did a perfect job on this one. So 96% said fear of complications, and you're absolutely right. Let's just take a look at the other options. Fear of hypoglycemia, we know that's not right because there's no mention in the vignette about hypoglycemia, being on insulin, any fear around hypo. So you're right on the money on that one. That is not the right answer. Reluctance to start on insulin, never mentioned in the case study. You know, his father wasn't on insulin. We know his father had complications, but no insulin was mentioned. panic disorder. One person, I think, chose that, but that's not the right answer. And if you chose that, that's okay. You just want to kind of think, if I choose the wrong answer, you want to reflect and say, you know, am I reading more into the question than there really is? So you just really want to take the information you have at hand. So panic disorder was not the right one. Sorry about that. But a fear of complications, yes, that is the right answer, and 96% of you chose that. So great job, team. Okay, let me get rid of these drawings here. Vignette-style question two. So we're on the same guy. What is most likely to be a potential barrier to lifestyle change for this gentleman? Let me go ahead and launch that. What is most likely to be a barrier to lifestyle change based on the information that we have about this patient? All right. So this is, yeah, this you want to go back to the original vignette and really think, what information do I have? And how can that help me answer this question most accurately? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share with you what you chose. So 58% of you said difficulty exercising due to obesity. Well, certainly that seems like an option, because we do know when patients are obese, it's difficult to move and exercise. It takes a lot of energy because of the body weight. And also, a lot of people when they are overweight or obese are shy, you know, to go out and exercise in public. So this makes a lot of sense to me. But let's look at our other options. B, excessive alcohol intake. Now, nobody chose that because that was not mentioned in the vignette. Good job, everybody. Now, C, teenage children. So in this vignette, we did say he has teenage children, but it doesn't say that the teenage children are wild or that they're, you know, out partying all the time and he's worried about them. It doesn't say that the teenage children occupy all of his time. So it doesn't seem in this situation that teenage children would be a potential barrier. So let's go ahead and get rid of that. Now, what about this D, long work hours? Now, some of you did choose this one, so I want to spend some time talking about this, because he is a professor. So we would assume that a professor works a lot of hours, but it never mentions that in the vignette. It doesn't say he's a workaholic, he works, you know, a long day. You know, for all we know, he could be like a real slacker professor. I'm sure you all have had that type of professor in your life. He doesn't really work that hard. Maybe he's on sabbatical. We don't even know. They didn't even mention anything in the vignette about his work hours. So based on the information we have, we can only choose the best answer. Let me just get my highlighter here. And the best answer is A, difficulty exercising due to obesity. Let me hide this. Okay. So difficulty exercising due to obesity is the best answer. And 60% of you chose that, so that's really terrific. Okay, and if you chose the other ones, it's just information for you to say, don't read too much into the question. Okay, let's go on to the next vignette. Okay, let me erase what I have on the screen here. The patient requests information about healthy eating. Which meal planning approach best suits this individual until he can see a registered dietitian? Okay, so what's the key intent of this question? Well, until he sees the RD, what information can we share with him? Okay, so here's the options. I'm going to go ahead and launch a poll. 1,200 calorie exchange plan. Avoid all concentrated sweets. Eat three meals a day with snacks in between. Or healthy eating based on my plate method. So Somebody asked me on the question, would helping friends and family outside the clinic be counted as hours? I would say no, and according to the information I shared with you earlier on the slide, helping family or friends doesn't really count as actual hours. It really needs to be in a structured environment. You can always ask the NCBDE because sometimes they may have a different take on things, but just from what I've read about their rules, generally speaking, I would say no. Oh, somebody asked, would shadowing a current CDE count as volunteer hours? Absolutely, but you have to do more than shadow her. You have to actually do diabetes self-management education training. So if you're out there and you're teaching along with a diabetes educator, absolutely, those hours do count. And hours, you know, doing program development and program planning count too. Somebody asked me, do phone calls to diabetes patients count as hours? I think so. I mean, as long as you're providing diabetes self-management education, those hours should count. As you know, I'm just sharing the information with you, so the ultimate deciders are the NCBDE. But if you speak to your supervisor and say, you know what, I really want these hours to count. I'm trying to gather them. Here's how they define diabetes self-management experience. This is what I'm doing. And your supervisor says, yeah, I think that's a good match. She attests to that, then that is considered diabetes self-management education. Okay, let's get back to question 3. So what is the best meal planning approach that will suit this individual? Let's just start with the first one here, a 1,200 calorie exchange plan. Well, we used to use that in the past. It's really old-fashioned. Nobody chose that, and that is not the right answer. It's not based on science. And, again, we're supposed to individualize. We're not supposed to, you know, one meal plan doesn't fit everybody. So this is really important. We need to individualize our approaches. What about avoid all concentrated sweets? Now, I just want to point out one word that's in this answer that's going to alert you, the word all. Remember those words I said? So this answer has the word all. And actually, it's not based in science. We know that people with diabetes can incorporate sugar and sweets into their meal plan as long as they count them as part of their carbohydrate intake. So if this was an answer you chose, you might want to take a look at the medical nutrition therapy guidelines and be familiar with those. And they're part of the ADA standards of care. What about C? Eat 3 meals with snacks in between. So again, this is actually the wrong answer because it's not individualized, it's not based on science, and actually a lot of patients who were doing this were gaining weight because they were, you know, having a higher intake of calories than they really needed. D, healthy eating based on my plate method. And actually 81% of you chose that, and that is the right answer. That, you know, looking at all of these, it's the best approach until that patient can see a dietitian. So great job, everybody. Okay, it's 12:27, and I know many of you probably need to get back to work pretty soon. So we just have one or two more sample questions that we're going to go over, and then we'll take some questions. Metformin is an anti-diabetic agent different than that of sulfonylurea drugs. Some features of the drug are that it... Okay, so let's just stop for a second and think, what is the main intent of this question? Really, they want to know, what are the major features of metformin? Okay, keeping that in mind, I'm going to launch this poll. So after this question, we just have one more. And then you can go ahead and take a look at the answers and choose what you think is the best answer. Did I launch this? Okay, let me launch. Sorry, guys. Okay, so it's launched now officially. And I'm going to go ahead and answer some other questions that people had. If audited, how are hours turned in? There's no official way to log your hours. It's just like a sheet of paper with your supervisor's signature. There's no official log sheet. So you can make up your own. And somebody asked, can an MD sign off for hours? Yeah, if the MD is considered your supervisor and he's watching you provide DSME, he certainly can sign off on those hours, him or her. Let me see somebody else. Do webinars or other CEs count towards your 400 hours? No. Taking classes doesn't count towards your CE, towards your practice hours. You need 15 hours of CE to take the exam, but the only way you've gathered the practice hours is by providing diabetes self-management education. Okay, so 70% of you have voted on this. This is a hard question. Now, let me say this to you. What if you're not really sure what metformin is or what its side effects or its main actions are? Well, you could download our diabetes medication pocket card, and I sent you a link to those. And our diabetes medication pocket card summarizes all the medications that are out there, dosing, main consideration, and side effects. That would be a terrific study tool. So if you didn't know the answer to this question, that's okay. You just know you need to study more on medications, and the pocket tool is a really good resource for you. Okay, so let's go over these together. It's asking us, what are the main features or some of the features of metformin? A. So 22% of you chose this. So let's spend a minute going over this answer. Stimulates insulin secretion. Okay, that seems like promising, right? Even if you didn't know anything about the drug, you like that it stimulates insulin secretion because that would help lower blood sugars. But let's look at the second half. Increases hepatic glucose production. Well, any drug for diabetes would not have as its action increase hepatic glucose, because that means in English the blood sugars go up. It means the liver is producing extra sugar. So just even if you didn't know anything about metformin, no diabetes drug would actually increase hepatic glucose production. So this is the wrong answer. Okay, B. Some of you chose this one, causes hypoglycemia. Actually, metformin does not cause hypoglycemia. And how would you know that? You just would have to know the considerations and the action of metformin. Metformin tells the liver not to release so much sugar. So that's its main action, but it doesn't cause low blood sugar. Okay, let's look at C. Lowers hyperglycemia in persons with diabetes, but does not lower blood glucose levels in people without diabetes. So 75% of you chose this. And this is kind of one of those weird answers. You're like, wow, this is a kind of a head scratcher. But you for sure know the first part is right. It lowers hyperglycemia in people with diabetes. The second half you may or may not know, but you know this is right. So let's consider this, and let's look at D. Nobody chose D because it says it results in weight gain and increase in plasma glucose. So no diabetes drug would raise your plasma glucose. So C is the best answer. C is the best answer. Okay, great job, everyone. Let's go on to our last question. And if for some reason you need to go back to work, just, you know, feel reassured that we're going to record this so you could take a look at the questions later on. But we just have this last one to do. A person with type 2 diabetes is on twice daily dose of basal bolus insulin and complains of waking up with morning headaches. If the fasting capillary blood glucose is 291, this person should be advised to do what? So what is the key intent of this question? Well, a patient wakes up with high morning fasting. Well, how do we adjust their medication? But we certainly have to consider what else is in this case study that they complain of waking up with morning headaches and they're on basal bolus. So I won't talk for a minute. I'm going to go ahead and launch this one. What should we advise this patient to do? All right. This is the most complicated question, so yeah, take your time, think through it. And what I'm going to do is go ahead and after we answer this question, we have a few more slides, I'll answer your questions because you all have a lot of questions for me, which is great. I love them. All right, well, 81% of you have voted, so I'm going to go ahead and close this. Thank you very much, and let's go over this together. So half of you chose answer A as the right answer, so let's investigate this further. So a person's on with type 2s on twice daily dose of basal bolus. We have to know what that means. Basal bolus means, the basal means a long-acting insulin. The bolus means a short-acting insulin. So they're on a combination of this twice a day. And they wake up with morning headaches. So we need to know, what is the significance of morning headaches? Well, I'm going to tell you what the significance is. That people who experience nocturnal hypoglycemia or low blood sugars at night often wake up in the morning complaining of headaches. So they're telling us something through that information, that low blood sugar has occurred and that patient's waking up with a headache in the morning because of it. Now, the fasting capillary blood glucose is 291. Why is it up if they went low in the middle of the night? Well, that's another concept you'd need to be familiar with, called the Somogyi effect. When blood sugars go low, we release adrenaline and other hormones that crank it back up. So this patient's blood sugar is high in the morning, not because they're not getting enough insulin, but because they got too low in the middle of the night. And we know that because of the morning headache. Okay. So let's take a look at the answers now. Increase evening dose of basal insulin. So many of you chose that, and I understand why, because you're thinking, wow, if their morning is high, we need to increase the nighttime insulin, the long-acting. But in this situation, that would not be the right answer because of that nocturnal hypoglycemia. So that's not the right answer. So what if you got that wrong? How do you learn about this? Well, one thing you could do is, really, I would say I have an online course on insulin and pattern management, and that's a really terrific program that goes over basal bolus, looking at patterns, looking at low blood sugars, high blood sugars, patient symptoms, and things like that. Or you could read a chapter on insulin therapy in a book. Those are two different ways. Or you could just, you know, work with somebody who does insulin management all the time and ask some questions. Okay, B, did anybody choose this? One person did. Increase the morning dose of bolus insulin. Well, that's the wrong answer, too. I understand why you chose that. The morning blood sugar is high, so we should give them a blast of insulin to bring it down. But the truth is, if morning's high, we have to look at the night before to see what's happening. So usually to fix a morning high, we do something with the insulin the night before. But in this situation, we know we need to actually take a different course because of the low blood sugar. Check 3 a.m. blood sugar. 40% of you chose that. That's a great idea. Why? Because we want to see what is happening at 3 a.m. Are they indeed getting low blood sugar? And if they are, it's going to provide us with more information about changes to make. And then D, we'll come back to C, eliminate bedtime snack. Some of you chose that. Some people think, well, if you're eating a snack at night, that's going to make your blood sugars go high. But 291 is very high, and plus we have the headache. So D is not the right answer. So of all of these answers, C is the best answer. You may say to yourself, well, I would like them to cut back on the nighttime insulin. We don't have that as a choice. So the best answer is check that 3 a.m. blood sugar. So I hope that was helpful for you, and I would just always encourage you, for the areas that you're not as familiar with, just to study those areas. You know, just say, maybe I'm a dietitian, I do medical nutrition therapy, but I'm not as familiar with medication. So that's an area you study. And for nurses, we need to study a lot about medical nutrition therapy. And pharmacists know a lot about medication, but may need to study more, maybe about behavior change. So all of us have our strengths, and all of us have areas we need to study more. And that's the great part about this exam. You get to become the best diabetes educator that you can be, because you learn things that you normally wouldn't pursue. You learn and you expand your breadth of knowledge. So let's talk about studying and some strategies for success. And the main thing I want to say, and I'm, you know, as far as how much longer we'll be going, about 5 more minutes, and then I'll answer your questions. You just want to find your best time to study and know what your learning style is. I like to move around a lot when I study, but maybe you need quiet and solitude. So set up a study plan, schedule a time, make an appointment with yourself. And you may even want to consider getting a study group. Sometimes study groups can be distracting, and they can be more focused on having fun and socializing. But if you set up a study group where you set up the rules and, you know, you bring in this chapter and review it, or you talk about medications, then you can really, it can be a tremendous source of support and encouragement. And then how do we spend our time? We're super busy people. I know that. So review what you know, and that would be the least amount of time on studying, 30 to 40%. But the new material that's new to you, that's awkward, you're uncomfortable with, spend the most time on that. Teach someone else the content. When you teach someone else, you learn a lot, believe me. I teach a lot, and as I teach, it just becomes a part of me. So the more I talk about it and share it, the more integrated it becomes into my knowledge base. And knowledge equals confidence. And as you study, your knowledge base expands, and so does your confidence. And confidence can really help combat test anxiety. So when you're getting ready for the exam, as you're thinking about it, sometimes we may be very self-critical. And I would give yourself permission to be your own best cheerleader and to say, you know what, I've studied really hard for this exam. I'm working, you know, to make this exam a success for me. I'm studying the best I can given my time and my limitations. And this is really important for me to do. And so, you know, keep those positive affirmations up. It doesn't have to be Pollyanna-ish or, you know, exaggerated. Just be realistic with yourself and just think what your best friend would tell you, how they would coach you, and kind of use that as your inner dialogue. Keep breathing. Rest well the night before. Know how to get to test site. Arrive early. And then know your stuff. And what I've talked about as far as, you know, gathering information about areas you're less comfortable with are two books that I have here. Diabetes Self-Management Education Desk Reference, and the Review Guide. These are published by the AADE, and they're just full of excellent information about all aspects of diabetes. And the book is the resource, and the Review Guide has 200 test questions. Now, the Review Guide has 200 sample test questions, but when you purchase the book, you have access to an additional 200 questions from the AADE. So you have actually 400 sample test questions. And I think that's really helpful for people. The more test questions you can take, the more you can feel comfortable and confident about the exam. You are going to do great. Just the fact that you've attended this webinar and that, you know, you're participating today, I already know you're a step ahead. So I want to thank you so much for attending this webinar. And I'm going to turn off the recording button and then answer your questions. So thank you so much, and if you want to hear people's questions and hear the answers, please stay. Otherwise, thank you, and have a great rest of your day.